Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today, we're going to be discussing Boko Haram's connections and international sources of funding. I'm joined by a very special guest, my very good friend and a returning guest, James Barnett. James is a PhD candidate at the University of Oxford and also a fellow at the Hudson Institute in Washington, D.C. James, it's very great to see you. I look forward to a wonderful conversation.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Michael. It's a pleasure to be back.
Brilliant. The last time you joined us, we was in Nigeria, we spoke about, and that's, that, you know, we spoke about, I guess it was Somaliland and the agreements with Ethiopia, the recognition with Ethiopia, and that has remained one of our most viewed episode. So I'm hoping we have the same effect. We have the
James. That's a very high standard I've set.
Yes, indeed. So, but we are going to look at Let me begin by saying, what is the scope? I know in the last couple of years, Boko Haram, there's been Boko Haram. I wouldn't say Boko Haram is at its peak. Boko Haram, you know, is past this peak. But we've been seeing a lot of factions and a lot of attacks recently, and it's been in the news recently as well. What is the scope? Let's start from this. What is the state? What is the status of Boko Haram right now?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I guess it depends on how you define Boko Haram, right? If you use the term as being synonymous with kind of the original faction and kind of insurgent movement that we often scholars will often use the abbreviation JAS or JASDJ for the Arabic name that it actually goes by, because of course the group never actually called itself Boko Haram. So if we're talking about that specific faction, then that's one question. If we're talking about, I think what you probably mean is the Boko Haram conflict broadly, right? Which I think, you know, is you can refer that to kind of all the violence, the jihadist violence in the Northeast, although of Nigeria and the Lake Chad Basin more broadly, although increasingly it's also, there are manifestations of it in Northwestern North Nigeria, some of the kind of central, what they call the North Central states of Nigeria. And these days it's getting even more complicated because you have also the broader instability and Salafi jihadist violence in the Sahel region. So you have, some of these groups that operate in Niger and Benin also kind of increasingly encroaching on Nigeria. So I think, you know, if we talk about kind of Boko Haram, meaning the broader conflict that really kicked off in the Northeast in 2009, I would say that the conflict is fragmented, but it's still quite intense, though, you know, with varying degrees of intensity in different regions, right? So you have two main factions in the Northeast. You have the JAS and then ISWAP, the Islamic State West Africa province. ISWAP is often, you know, still referred to in kind of literature or media reporting as kind of a faction or a splinter of Boko Haram, which in some ways is true, but it's been the larger and more dominant and I think kind of better organized faction for some years now. Although there, you know, and JAS is kind of, to some extent, there are really several kind of factions or cells of JAS operating in the Northeast that in somewhat kind of autonomous manner. But You know, that factionalism is one kind of important element of the question, and that factionalism can actually be quite violent and intense, right? Throughout kind of from, I think, roughly late 2022 throughout 2023, there was actually quite a lot of fighting in the Northeast between ISWAP and JAS, particularly the JAS group that, you know, is operating around the Lake Chad region, kind of in those islands there. So that was kind of giving a bit of, to some extent, you know, a bit of respite to, I think, the, you know, the security forces and local civilians, because the jihadists were kind of fighting themselves more than they were concentrating on fighting local militaries. But, you know, that's, while that conflict and stuff is still there, what we've seen is that both of these groups, both the JAS led by Bukura Doro in the Northeast, but also ISWAP, that they're still very capable, not only of, you know, attacks against security forces, which, you know, in the case of ISWAP, I think they are kind of doing smaller scale attacks than they did maybe 5 or 6 years ago. There's kind of a bit of a, what you might call a strategic stalemate insofar as that ISWAP can no longer do the big massed attacks against the Nigerian military that it used to, but they're also not defeated. But we've seen, you know, from the Bakura faction also some very deadly attacks. Most recently, you know, or I think a couple months ago now in Chad, where they killed several dozen Chadian soldiers. So both of these groups are still militarily quite capable, and they're still you know, waging or inflicting a lot of violence against civilians in the Northeast. You know, here there is kind of a broad difference in strategy and ideology, I'd say, between JAS and ISWAP in terms of the kind of permissibility or the conditions under which they would kill Muslim civilians. Both groups attack, you know, the regional militaries. They attack any institutions or individuals kind of affiliated with the state. But ISWAP, partially, you know, as a result of this kind of the split with Abu Bakr Shekau some years ago, they typically are less, how should I say, you know, they try to be a bit more discriminate in terms of not just kind of killing anyone who is not an active member of the group in the way that Shekau did. They're trying to do a bit more of a hearts and minds approach, targeting, again, only kind of these, you know, rural Muslim civilians in the Northeast who are not actively cooperating with the military. So that's kind of created, I think, the paradigm that a lot of, you know, analysts and scholars of Boko Haram and this conflict in the last few years have kind of been in this mindset of, okay, JAS is kind of the more predatory, indiscriminate group that doesn't have as much of a, maybe a strategy for growth or expansion, whereas ISWAP is actually in some ways more of the dangerous group because they're trying more of a hearts and mind insurgency. They're the ones that have the, you know, the strong international links and, you know, very much a franchise of the Islamic State. But I think that, you know, the reality is, in fact, a bit more complex and nuanced. What we're seeing is, you know, JAS is also under the Bakura faction. They've been experimenting with, you know, what you could call kind of proto rebel governance, jihadist governance, and kind of to an extent that the group didn't really do under Shekau. And we're also seeing that ISWAP, you know, it's important to remember, you know, they're not exactly kind of the softer side of jihad, you know, which is, I think, a somewhat tongue-in-cheek or ironic phrase or term that some, you know, analysts or scholars have used, because they're also, as we saw with this very horrific massacre, I believe it was last August, they're also, you know, engaged in indiscriminate or, you know, pretty severe violence against civilians when they think it fits their strategic objectives. So that's kind of the broader balance in the Northeast. The political situation, specifically between Nigeria and Niger, has also been, I think, a complicating or compounding factor since the coup in July 2023 and the subsequent kind of real deterioration of relations. There's been, you know, there were some positive signs kind of later last year, I think over the summer, kind of signs of normalization and a resumption of cooperation between the Nigerian and Nigerian militaries under the auspices of the MNJTF. But recently there's been real kind of, you know, the Nigerian junta has kind of, I think, tried to scapegoat some of the violence that they're experiencing, some of the insecurity, kind of putting that blame on Nigeria. So the relationship is still not, you know, it's still not what it was before the coup. And that has real impacts on the situation in the Northeast.
You've mentioned so many things, but let me start from one thing. So from 2009, you know, the Boko Haram we knew then had clear agendas or stated agendas, which is, you know, Sharia turn Nigeria into a Sharia state. But what do they want now? Both Boko Haram and Iswap.
Yeah, I mean, I think the ultimate objective is the same insofar as they want to establish, you know, it's not just like, you know, they don't want a Sharia state in the same way that, like, you know, Governor Sani Arima in Zamfara in 1999 introduced Sharia and made it a Sharia state. And then the, you know, 11 other northern states followed. What they want is to, you know, kind of, it's the same goal that, say, you know, the global Salafi jihadist movement have, that both, you know, the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda, they have different strategies, somewhat different ideologies, but they ultimately want the same thing, which is the, you know, the erasure of kind of the entire current international system, the Westphalian system of nation states. And they want a transnational, you know, kind of caliphate essentially resurrected, that is based on their very specific, you know, hardline kind of interpretation of Sharia law. I think, you know, broadly, I'd categorize, you know, both JAS and ISWAP as Salafi jihadist movements, you know, to indicate that they are kind of an outgrowth or a splintering, if you will, of kind of a broader Salafist worldview in terms of this very doctrinaire, you could call it maybe puritanical sense of you know, kind of what an Islamic state and society should look like. Mm-hmm. But they differ, of course, from the, you know, millions of other Salafis around the world who are nonviolent insofar as that they want to wage a violent offensive jihad to achieve that. So I think that ultimately those objectives, you know, if you're talking ideologically, I think that's still the objective. On a day-to-day kind of level, on the level of kind of their operations or even their strategic level, of course, they're nowhere near, you know, doing anything like this, right? And the violence in Nigeria and the jihadist violence kind of specifically, it's in a position where I'd say the core insurgency is largely contained to the Northeast and to the, you know, kind of the rural sectors of the Northeast, you know, particularly in Borno states, parts of Yobe and Adamawa, and then parts of neighboring Cameroon, Niger, and Chad. But, you know, the jihadists are not, this isn't like Afghanistan in July 2021. It's not like Somalia today or even, you know, Mali today, right? I think that the jihadist violence is in many ways more contained, and the state as a whole is not in as weak a position. So there's no, you know, there's no real risk that, like, they're going to be, you know, raising black flags over Abuja and then kind of taking over the country in the way that the Taliban did. So that idea of creating like a, you know, a Salafi jihadist proto-caliphal state is incredibly distant. It's not going to, you know, it's not going to happen. But at the same time, they're also fighting for their survival. They're continuing their insurgency because, you know, they believe in the cause and, you know, other various factors, I think. But to a large extent, I think the leadership of these groups does, you know, ultimately believe in this. And I think they do believe that they will eventually prevail and stuff. But, you know, they're, I think in the Northeast, they're trying to show that they're still strong, that they're still relevant. They're trying to control the local population. And, you know, like I said, some of the stuff needed for survival and to wage an insurgency, they're trying to control logistics corridors so they can get supplies, weapons, ammunition. They're trying to you know, exert their influence over local civilians so that, you know, both they have those that cooperation, but also source of resources, taxation and stuff. They're trying to, you know, to a large extent in the Northeast, I think they're trying to outgun or outmaneuver each other to kind of, you know, re-monopolize the jihad under kind of one banner in the way it was from, say, 2009 to 2015, 2016, before the ISWAP JAS kind of fissure. But then it does, you know, all that said, it gets a bit complicated because, you know, a lot of my research is actually not in the Northeast of Nigeria, though I, you know, I've been there and I'm planning to go back soon. And
yeah, I was going to come there. Yeah, go on. Yeah.
Yes, right. So as you know, right, I do a lot of work in the Northwest and then the North Central states, and that's an area that I've been looking at for several years.
Let me ask you to hold on a bit on the Northwest, because I'm going to come there. But I wanted to quickly answer this before, since we're talking on the Northeast, we'll go to the Northwest in a minute. So you, earlier on, you were talking about the distinction, you know, between ISWAP and, or they're not too distinctive in their tactics in terms of like attack on civilians, or the ability to be able to use, you know, harsh measures on the civilian for that strategic objective. You also talked about the not so distinctive nature of that attempt at governance. You particularly use the Bakura faction, how it's kind of like modeling ISWAP kind of administrative heart and mind kind of like approach. But as I guess the question is, when we often in the literature, when they talk about, they usually want to compare ISWAP with jazz using the local global dichotomy kind of thing, trying to say Bukram is more locally called, you know, his influence is more locally, why ISWAP is. Does that relate to the struggle, the fraction between this group, the struggle between this group? Does that have any impact in their struggle, in their fight?
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty complex matter, and I feel like the local global dichotomy sometimes, you know, using that paradigm can maybe cause more confusion than it can be helpful, because you know these two, they don't have to be, and they never were mutually exclusive, right? So I think that nowadays what we're talking about is, like, in terms of direct ties, affiliation, kind of franchising, right? And that case, yes, it's clear, you know, ISWAP is a franchise, not just a franchise, like an important affiliate, an important province of the Islamic State's broader global efforts and stuff. Now, it's a highly autonomous one. It is one rooted in the local context. The entire Boko Haram conflict, you know, is rooted in the local, of course, Nigerian political and social context, but also inspired by kind of global Salafi jihadist thought, first in Al-Qaeda and stuff, and then, you know, more recently in terms of the Islamic State. In terms of the kind of day-to-day operations of these groups and stuff, because ISWAP is that, you know, is part of that global Islamic State network, I think it lends the group probably to some extent more kind of, you know, some resources and advantages that maybe the Bakura faction wouldn't have, because the Bakura faction, as far as we know, doesn't have any, you know, the same degree of kind of international connection or you know, you can call it even sponsorship. But I think the flip side of that is that also, these days, kind of the dichotomy has actually shifted a bit from what it was maybe 10 years ago. ISWAP is actually probably doing more for kind of the Islamic State model or franchise globally than the Islamic State is giving in return, if that makes sense. And just to kind of think, illustrate this. So, you know, at the time, right, Boko Haram from, say, 2009 to 2015, it was not a formal affiliate of any kind of global jihadist group. There was some interest, and you know, even if you go into the early history, there are kind of different factions where some members of the group wanted to be more internationally aligned. Some of them actually, I think, did split and have kind of formed a group called Ansaru that was a bit more connected to the global Al-Qaeda network, or at least, you know, through Algeria and stuff. But the Boko Haram, you know, under the leadership of first Muhammad Yusuf and then Abu Bakr Shekau, never pledged what's called bayah, right? This kind of oath of loyalty that you pledge to an individual, not a group. But, you know, in the case of Al-Qaeda, they would have pledged it to bin Laden. And then after that, Zawahiri. In the case of Islamic State, they pledged it to Baghdadi or whoever the current caliph is. They killed like four of them. So, but I think that question or that idea of the bayah is very important. And so it's, you know, Boko Haram never did that. They never kind of put themselves fully into a global jihadist camp. Now, obviously, that started to change in 2015, 2016. That's when you had this split between JAS and ISWAP. And part of the reason for that split, as I've kind of written about in the past in some of my past writing, and I've interviewed a few people who were kind of senior commanders, defectors who were at the time senior commanders in that group, essentially, and you know, there was already internal dissent within the Boko Haram movement. There was some skepticism of Abu Bakr Shekau's tactics. Some people thought they were very extreme, particularly some of this stuff about, you know, targeting Muslims and stuff like suicide bombings, using women and children as suicide bombers, attacking mosques. Again, Shekau had this ultra exclusivist kind of view that essentially any Muslim who does not willingly come and join, you know, come and join us in our camps and fight with us is essentially, you know, he's a disbeliever. Yeah. So you had that internal kind of disagreement and dissent. And then at the same time, Boko Haram was trying to kind of they were testing the waters with the Islamic State, or maybe it's better to say the Islamic State was testing the waters with Boko Haram. They and you know, some other scholars like Vincent Foucher and others have done really kind of good detailed work on this, that we know that the Islamic State sent money, they sent some trainers. First they were talking, you know, through remote communications, and eventually they sent people. And that, you know, it was kind of that contact with those external jihadis that allowed, that kind of cemented that split essentially within Boko Haram. Because as one of the guys that I interviewed, he's a, you know, is a senior jihadist defector. This was some years ago for a research project in Nigeria. You know, he talked about it as, well, we'd all, you know, a lot of us had kind of already started to have doubts about Shekau, especially because at that point, the Nigerian military, the regional militaries were responding. So Boko Haram was losing ground. And, but, you know, it was getting that kind of the external authority that, you know, the Islamic State, right, the Caliph himself, Abu Bakr Baghdadi, they take that, you know, very seriously. They see him as the leader of Muslims. So they say, when he was also telling us, when the Islamic State was telling us that Shekau's tactics were wrong, that was kind of what influenced, you know, this fissure. And so essentially, and the Islamic State ended up lending support to the one group over the other, to ISWAP over Shekau's faction. So at that time, in that early kind of period, and maybe for the first few years, the Islamic State was really sending, you know, kind of money, as I think to some extent material, but mostly money and skills, you know, in terms of trainers and stuff. So they were helping the Islamic State improve their tactics. They had Arabs coming in through Libya, but also stuff like remote training. They had a kind of sophisticated network that even ran through Dubai and Abu Dhabi of money laundering, how they get the money into Nigeria. And then they were also very important on kind of broader theological and strategic matters. They gave advice to Boko to ISWAP about, you know, strategy, tactics, but also kind of stuff like, how do you govern an Islamic State, right? In the territory you have, how do you, you know, here are some of the elements that ISIS used in Raqqa and Mosul, and here's how you could use them in Nigeria. Now, if we fast forward to today, to 2025, to get somewhat, you know, belatedly to your question, the dynamic has shifted a lot, right? All of this, what I was describing, was at a time when you still had like the ISIS caliphate in Iraq and Syria, and now that was destroyed, right, in Baghouz in March 2019. So the Islamic State, they're still in Iraq and Syria. The leadership is mostly seems to be in Syria, or maybe, you know, some people say Turkey, but that kind of that group in the core, you know, the so-called core provinces in the Middle East is weaker. But at the same time, Islamic State affiliates in Africa, not just ISWAP, but in other regions, have had, you know, a decent bit of growth and success over the past few years. And ISWAP has been one of the big ones in terms of, you know, not only its military success, which I think there's been less of in recent years, but in 2018, 2019, 2020, they were scoring some big wins in terms of overrunning military bases in the Northeast and stuff. But also kind of in terms of their governance, their propaganda, they can show, look, we're administering an Islamic State. So ISWAP started to become kind of very valuable to the broader Islamic State kind of franchise, if you will, to the broader Islamic State network. And we know that the Islamic State has these regional offices. There are two in Africa. There's the Al-Qarar office in East Africa and the Al-Furqan office in West Africa. And that essentially that West African office is kind of used to coordinate affairs and strategy and share best practices and stuff. And you know, essentially kind of, you know, coordinate jihadist strategy between ISWAP and the Lake Chad Basin area and then the Islamic State Sahel province, which is, you know, mostly operating in Mali, Niger, Burkina Faso. So at the moment, we don't hear as much about, you know, trainers going to ISWAP to train them in tactics. Although actually just recently ISWAP did release photos showing two foreign fighters. I think they said like a Palestinian and a Moroccan that were there. So it is still happening. But I think that by and large, like ISWAP's model, like ISWAP, it kind of has a model that it's been using for several years in terms of, you know, and it adapts to the local circumstances, right? They used to mass their forces and use, you know, armored trucks and pickups, Hilux that they, you know, looted from previous military attacks. They used to mass these big groups and then try to overrun these forward operating bases. They were doing that for a few years, but they can't really do that so easily anymore because the Nigerian military, the army, and the air force have improved coordination. It's harder for them to do that. So they've kind of shifted their tactics in line with the local dynamics of the conflict. So they're kind of doing, they have a model that's, you know, sustaining their insurgency to a large extent. So I don't think they necessarily need that kind of day-to-day management or guidance or advice. I wouldn't say it was ever management, but that guidance and advice at the more tactical and operational level, I don't think that's actually as important for them as it used to be. But the one area where apparently ISWAP does, I think, still take real serious guidance is on kind of the broader strategy and specifically on theological matters. And so, you know, you hear this from defectors, you see it in stuff like the United Nations, you know, reports on Islamic State and Al-Qaeda, that, you know, the periods where you hear of kind of, you know, foreigners like emissaries or envoys from the Islamic State coming from the Middle East, usually from Libya or through Libya down to Lake Chad, is often when there's kind of internal disagreement in ISWAP about, you know, kind of what strategy to pursue, essentially, or about a kind of ideological question and stuff. And so there, I think, again, it's important to remember the ideological or theological dimension of this, which is that ISWAP still sees, you know, the Islamic State as the legitimate, valid, caliphate, even though it lost its core territories in Iraq and Syria. It's in the process of rebuilding, is how they see it. And so to them, you know, they really, on that kind of broader guidance and vision and stuff, they still defer to that, you know, to those external authorities as real authorities, I think, that should guide their actions. But on the day-to-day level, you know, they're not, I don't think they're not getting orders for, okay, attack this outpost or that outpost from the Middle East. But like I said, you know, very recently there was evidence, or not evidence, you know, ISWAP published the fact that they have some Arab trainers in their camps. So it's,
I agree with you mostly. I agree with you mostly. And it kind of mirrors my research as well. When you talk about, first of all, Boko Haram, let's say Boko Haram under Shekau, when ISWAP was, ISIS was caught in Boko Haram, because the way I've said it is a kind of like a mutual, because sometimes people look at it as like a one-way stream. Now, ISIS was also caught in Boko Haram. Boko Haram presented itself, you know, as presented itself as a credible, provided that route or, you know, into the largest Muslim population in Africa, which would be northern Nigeria. So, and also in my own estimation, Boko Haram was at a decline at the time and needed ISIS, whatever, to also boost his whatever. So it was more like a mutual kind of stuff. But in terms of the local, since we've gained to the connection, the local, whatever, dynamic, you mentioned Ansaru. And I think in my perspective, I think Boko Haram has always struggled with defining, or with, Boko has always wrestled, even before this external stuff, with the local, whether it's a local or whether it's going to be moved by external, the transnational jihadist narrative or jihadist discourse. And as early as 2011-12 was when I had the Ansaru. But now this comes to your research now. So when Ansaru splitted from Boko Haram, Ansaru operated in the northwest. It was mainly based in the northwest, north central. Not the Boko Haram core, not. But we still see that kind of like dynamic still going on now with either is a Boko Haram faction. Before Shekau died, Shekau tried to take credit for the prison, or was it the kidnap or the prison, the kidnap of the boys that was carried out by the bandits or the militia team.
Yeah, Conqueror abduction.
Yeah. And then we've also seen in your work as well, which I've read, we've also seen attempts, Boko Haram trying to have a strong foothold in Northwest. So there's always been that kind of like division. So I wanted to talk about what is Boko Haram's status in the Northwest? And it seems the Northwest seems to be the corridor, like Riley mentioned, for groups in the Sahel or the wider jihadist groups in the Sahel coming into Nigeria. So is Boko Haram still a player, or is it ISIS? Because is ISIS just focused on the Lake Chad area? Or is ISWAP, is ISWAP also trying to connect with these groups in the Northwest? What is this complex maze? Can you explain this complex maze in the Northwest?
Yeah, I mean, thanks, Michael. It's the situation's, you know, always evolving, right? And I'm even kind of at the moment working on new research, trying to kind of make sense of this and stuff. So it's good to maybe like have a check-in every 6 months to give a, you know, updated assessment. But by and large, you mentioned some of the stuff I've written earlier on this. My argument and you know, what I still see today in the current dynamics is that expansion by jihadist groups, and specifically the Nigerian jihadist groups, it's maybe a bit different if we talk about, say, JNIM and IS Sahel province, who are kind of newer, to some extent, newer entrants into the space. But, you know, we could talk about that after. But the Nigerian jihadists in particular have actually had more trouble expanding into the Northwest. They faced a lot of challenges there that I think a lot of analysis of, you know, jihadist insurgency and a lot of analysis of conflict in the Northwest has kind of typically has maybe missed those nuances. So, you know, the context here is that Northwestern Nigeria has been suffering from its own really acute levels of violence for, you know, depending on how you define it, you know, certainly the past 5 years have been some of the most violent. And then, but even throughout the 2010s, really from the early 2010s, you had growing levels of intercommunal conflict and rural banditry, and the two have really kind of meshed to the point that they're essentially, I think, one kind of broader conflict. So you have dozens of these different kind of warlords, these bandit gangs led by these kingpins. I call them warlords because I think that's a more accurate reflection of kind of their dynamics. The fact that they actually, in many instances, control territory. You know, they exert real influence over the rural population. So this conflict and this violence has been going on for a long time in the Northwest now. Boko Haram, you know, or jihadists in Nigeria have attempted to expand into the Northwest from their kind of core base in the Northeast, right? And it's very important to remember the Boko Haram conflict, really, it is, you know, rooted in a lot of the local dynamics and stuff in the Northeast. Early on, the group had, you know, they got supporters, they had fighters from all different parts of Nigeria and stuff, but the insurgency in 2009, it started in Maiduguri. Even if you want to take an earlier start date and refer to this incident called the so-called Nigerian Taliban, and this commune in Kanama, that was just a neighboring in Yobe State. So the Northeast has always been, in many ways, like the center of gravity of the insurgency, right? And to this day, most of the fighters, you know, in this insurgency, they hail from the Northeast, right? They're recruited locally, all that stuff. In the early kind of, for I'd say, you know, from say 2010 to 2014, 2015, Boko Haram was able to pull off, you know, and this was again under Shekau's leadership, they were able to pull off a lot of terrorist attacks across the North more broadly, but mostly in urban areas. So it wasn't kind of, they weren't using the issue of banditry as a vector so much. They had more of these kind of urban cells, Ansaru as well, right? In places like Kano, Zaria, Kaduna, in those areas. By 2015, the Nigerian security forces had kind of, you know, gotten their act together a bit more. They'd identified a lot of these cells, rolled them up. Like I said, and as you alluded to, they were applying pressure on Boko Haram in the Northeast. So the group kind of constricted, and so it wasn't able to do as much. And, you know, to date, we've not had kind of, you know, thankfully a repeat of the kind of high levels of you know, attacks and stuff that were that you had in the early 2010s. But what we've seen then is that since the mid-2010s onwards, various jihadists, you know, JAS, but then also ISWAP, and then also this Ansaru faction that kind of was essentially defunct or dormant by 2015 or so, 2016. A lot of its leaders were arrested or killed, kind of went underground, but then it reemerged around 2020, 2021, and it reemerged in the Northwest. So if you look at it as three main groups, JAS, Ansaru, and ISWAP, though in reality, as I'm finding, I think it's actually more complex than that. You have different networks, different commanders and stuff. You have the foreign groups. But let's just, you know, start with those three groups. They've been trying to come in, you know, they've made attempts repeatedly over the past 10 years to try to kind of expand into the Northwest by essentially exploiting the kind of prevalence of those bandits and the criminal violence, and also exploiting the intercommunal violence. Through, for example, adopting a kind of model in the case of, say, Ansaru, adopting a model that JNIM had, you know, adopted with pretty, you know, serious success in places like Burkina Faso and Mali, which is to insert itself into an intercommunal conflict, kind of defend one community against the other. And then that community is kind of indebted to, you know, and pushed into the arms of the jihadists. And, you know, by and large, that strategy, it's not had as much success, I think, as the jihadists had initially anticipated, in part because the banditry is so complex in its own right, and the bandits themselves are very powerful, very deadly, but in many ways very parochial figures. And so it's been very hard for jihadists to kind of recruit bandits en masse. And so we see, and I think, you know, to a large extent, that still remains the case. Now, you know, the caveat here, or the, you know, the counterpoint to this is that there are jihadists in the Northwest. They are, and, you know, not only are they in the Northwest, they are a problem in the Northwest. They have pulled off some really, you know, serious attacks, right? The Abuja Kaduna train kidnapping was conducted by this JAS Boko Haram kind of network led by one commander known as Sadiku. The Kuje prison break just outside of Abuja, you know, was conducted by ISWAP, but I think with collaboration from other jihadists utilizing transit corridors and stuff through the Northwest. Now you have the presence of, you know, I think Islamic State Sahel province, or you've had it intermittently for several years through these guys called La Kurawa in the Northwest. You have more stuff happening in Niger State that still, I think, researchers were trying to get a better sense of what the dynamics are, who the figures are. But all to say that, like, you know, this is a problem, but it's also very different from the Northeast. The jihadists have not monopolized violence, even among non-state actors in the Northwest, in a way that in the Northeast, you know, the main problem there is jihadism. Yes, you have banditry, you have, you know, all certainly other types of security issues, but the main problem there is jihadism. The jihadists control most territory, you know, if excluding the government, right, if we're talking about in the space of non-state actors, the jihadists control the most territory, they have the most weapons, whether it's ISWAP, the Bakura faction, Aliyu and Golde's faction, and the Mandara Mountains, you know, that's really the main issue in the Northeast. In the Northwest, my argument is that the banditry remains the main problem, and that the jihadists, they face, you know, and it's different for each group, right? JAS, ISWAP, Ansaru, some groups have more success than others, but all of them face the same kind of opportunities, but also constraints. And I think this is actually demonstrated by, you know, just a recent incident where it appears, I mean, you know, still trying to verify some details, but it appears that a very powerful bandit named Dogogide, who has a history of collaborating with jihadist groups, that his gang has actually been fighting with some JAS fighters of this network called Sadiku, which, you know, if this is confirmed, that would be interesting, because Sadiku's group had actually probably been in some ways the most successful of jihadists in the Northwest in terms of trying to cement, you know, kind of maintain ties with the bandits. There was a kind of very pragmatic political approach he took to all of this. But I think that there are limits to how much, you know, these jihadists can align with the bandits, in part because, you know, the bandits themselves, I'm using that term generally, but there's no bandit insurgency, right? There are dozens of different gangs. Sometimes they cooperate, but they also compete with each other. You have the egos of individual warlords and stuff. So, you know, all to say that it's actually the Northwest is such a complex conflict environment to begin with. This issue of banditry, the intercommunal conflict, all of that is very complex. And much as that, you know, has been a challenge for the Nigerian government and others in trying to address it, it's also to some extent been a challenge for some of these jihadists who are trying to expand into there. With, again, my final concluding point here will be that none of this is an excuse to be complacent. Because as I mentioned, right, there have already been big attacks by jihadists in the region. And, you know, the longer that they're there, the more that time that the jihadists have to learn how things work in the Northwest, to learn the personalities, what strategies work and what don't, you know, that's just a recipe for trouble. But it's also important, I think, not to be maybe alarmist and to recognize that, you know, the current kind of drivers of violence in the Northwest are still principally, I think, rooted in these more local issues, banditry, farmer herder violence and stuff. And so if you want to have solutions, you need to look at those local dynamics.
Exactly. Let me start from that. We might be able to have two more questions, but let me start with the first. Since you mentioned, you ended with that. So what it seems to me, you mentioned, which I've also seen in my research, but before I said, I want to say this in my own opinion as well, I think the analysis, I would say post 2015, what I've seen is less ideology, more competition. So there's the mercantilist kind of like approach, even among these jihadis, criminal network. Everybody's kind of like vying to have the monopoly, which is what Volis said, Demari said, that even when we look at, when we strip aside ideology, at the end of the day, if you look at the root, look at than Fodi's jihad. It was more about who controls, who has hegemony. So that is my opinion, but that's not the question I was going to ask. I was going to ask you, like you rightly mentioned, the jihadis in the north are exploiting pre-existing intercommunal clashes that have been there for long. And you did mention the Nigerian military, one, they've capitalized on the internecine warfare between all of the jihadists to gain. But you've also mentioned one critical thing to give them credit that they've improved in terms of their cooperation, the Navy, the this. But they've also, it does also seem that they've also not learned. I wanted to talk about one, there's been some air accidents where civilians have been, you know, maybe accidentally bombed in the northwest and all of that. And we've also seen also less from the government, broader government perspective, less attempt to deal with that root cause that is creating, giving the incentive for all of this, that these jihadis and all of that criminal groups are exploiting. So what is, how do you explain the military's approach and also the government, wider government approach? Then I might come to the last question about the international funding.
Sure. I think I want to start by saying I don't, I know you didn't ask it as a question, but I'm still going to take the liberty to treat it as one. I don't fully agree that there's no more ideology, you know, among the jihadist groups. I think if you look at the differences, you know, both between, say, JAS and ISIL.
No, I want to say, I'm not saying there's no ideology. If you look at JNIM, I think with JNIM, there was a point where they had to be reminded of their primary, this, that was, it was ideology. So I'm just going by, I'm not saying it's not there, but I'm just saying it's taking a back foot.
Sure. I think that what you see, and, you know, there's a lot to be written about this, and I'm hoping to, is that there's, you know, the different commanders, I think, especially when you start looking at the expansion of jihadis into the Northwest, different kind of commanders or networks or whatever take somewhat different approaches in terms of how pragmatic they'll be, how much they compromise on core ideological principles. And I think that can have, you know, it can have sometimes strategic or operational benefits, but it can also engender, you know, discord among the jihadis, because these are still very ideological, you know, at the level of leadership, at least, you know, ideological figures. So that's a very interesting, maybe, you know, some point down the line, once I've done more research, we can have another conversation about that. In terms of the military strategy, I mean, I think what you're essentially describing, and you mentioned those recent airstrikes, which have been mostly in, I think, you know, in the Northwest and the North Central region. Part of the problem is, you know, I mean, just if you look at a map of Nigeria today, right, there's insecurity in every region. The military is overstretched. The security forces are overstretched. In many instances, you know, the conflicts that you have today, the catalyst for those conflicts, you know, in some to some extent or another, was you know, repression from the security forces, right? So you sometimes get this dynamic wherein, you know, the security forces will kind of attack these radical or you know, heterodox dissident movements when they're kind of weak and not necessarily even fully violent yet, because they're kind of easier targets. And, you know, the governor, the politicians, the governors and stuff say, you know, go in, smash these people. And then that ends up, you know, making the problem bigger, to the point that it actually, these groups militarize, it becomes a broader conflict. And then that's actually more than the security forces can handle, especially when you have all these conflicts in different areas. I think, you know, I think we both agree, right, that the mid-2010s was kind of a turning point insofar as, you know, Boko Haram reached its territorial zenith. Then the militaries, you know, the MNJTF broadly, the Chadian and Nigerian militaries, you know, played an important role, but also the Nigerian military, you know, captured a lot of these areas. Then, like I mentioned, I think just in the past 5 years or so alone, there have also been kind of tactical and operational improvements that I think you do see have actually, you know, changed the battlefield picture. But, you know, the insurgency is not defeated, right? Insurgencies are very difficult to defeat, especially when they're rural. You know, Borno State, the second largest state in Nigeria, after Niger State, which is why one reason among others is very concerning that you now have these different jihadists going to Niger State, because that is a massive area and it's very hard to monitor, to police, to all that stuff. So, you know, the What I'd say is there's kind of a stalemate to an extent in the Northeast. And you know that it can fluctuate, you know, one way or another. It's again not a reason for complacency, but the situation, the violence, you know, in the group is, I think, you know, more contained territorially and operationally in that regard than it was, say, 10 years ago. But the part of the problem is that, you know, the Northwest has now gotten so violent over the past 5 years. As things were maybe, you know, the violence was reducing to some extent in the Northeast, the situation in the Northwest was escalating and getting worse. And so the government is kind of being very reactive and essentially using the same tools that they were using in the Northeast to try to tamp down on the situation in the Northwest. And this really actually kind of, I think, escalated under Buhari, who, you know, some of the first big military operations against bandits were launched under his tenure. And it was this idea, I think, partially, especially at that stage, it was partially rooted in, I think, maybe not fully understanding what the issue was or who the actors were and stuff. And also, you know, how, to some extent, how enmeshed banditry is in the local dynamics, social dynamics, economic dynamics, but also political dynamics. And I think that, you know, the problem is if you're going to take the what you're doing in the Northeast and take those tools and put it apply them to the Northwest without really changing the overall strategy and stuff, well, for starters, there's going to be, you know, there are going to be kind of problems inherent in that, including collateral damage, because as we've seen, you know, the there was a real issue, you know, especially I think in the kind of from the mid 2010s, you know, onwards or so, or you know, from the maybe say roughly 2013 to say 2020, I think is when you had most of those errant airstrikes in the Northeast, most famously the Ron one, but you know, just a lot of kind of collateral damage and stuff, right? So you know, you're using the same tools and stuff, and applying them to the Northwest, where the conflict is even more fluid, the actors are often harder to identify and stuff. So you're going to have, you know, the more you militarize that conflict, there's going to be collateral damage like that, and we've seen that, and that collateral damage is not only, you know, tragic and horrible in its own right, but it's strategically it's a challenge, it's politically it's a challenge, right? Because it reduces the trust, you know, between local communities and the security forces. It can also be politicized, and I think we're seeing that. We've seen that in you know the past year or so. So partially it's that, you know, military tools inherently and military responses, especially in the way that they're applied in Nigeria, you know, are going to, you know, they're not going to be able, not only can they not address everything on their own, but they're going to have their own kind of blowback and collateral. But it's also just that I think the problem in the Northwest is fundamentally different than the one in the Northeast. And unfortunately, in some ways, it's more complicated. You know, sometimes you talk to Nigerian government officials or analysts, and they'll say, actually, you know, the bandits should be easier to fight because they're not ideological, right? They're just in it for money. So you just need to tweak, you know, kind of change the incentive structure so that, you know, you just whack them a few more times with bombs and then they'll realize, oh, actually, you know, cattle rustling is risky. I'll stop. I, you know, if only it were that simple, right? There's a lot, like I mentioned, this is rooted in these kind of deeper issues and these communal tensions. Because the conflict is so fragmented, and because the bandits have achieved in the rural communities, they've achieved, you know, not I guess you could say they've collectively achieved a significant degree of kind of political and social influence, right? They are the, you know, the authorities in many of these rural,
The
yeah,
law
hard to reach communities. They don't govern collectively, right? There's no bandit, you know, organization. There's no Sharia council of the bandits like there is with ISWAP. But if you look at, you know, in aggregate, even though their authority is often contested and overlapping and stuff, they still have a lot of territory. So that in and of itself makes it a very tricky problem. And it means that, you know, as a military, if you're, or the security forces, if you're doing the kinetic approach, you have to be very careful because, you know, taking out one leader can actually end up complicating things because his gang could fragment, other leaders could emerge, you could have violence against civilians. I think, you know, the conflict it's very different, and I think its root causes and even in many ways in the current drivers. But some parallels to this would be the, you know, the drug wars in Latin America and specifically Mexico, where what, you know, I think all the empirical evidence is pretty clear that kind of the heavily kinetic leadership decapitation approach in isolation on its own doesn't actually necessarily reduce the violence. And if anything, it can actually create more blowback
It's
and
connected to
increase the violence. So I think that's one of the major challenges now. And I think the current government, the NSA, you know, they're looking at non-kinetic solutions alongside, even just in Kaduna State, I think it was about a week ago, you know, there was this big process of, oh, you know, amnesty for the bandits, they're laying down their arms. It's, you know, there have also been the non-kinetic approaches in the past, but at the state level rather than the federal level. There's not been a presidential amnesty like there was in the Niger Delta. And so what we've seen also is that those non-kinetic approaches, you know, the amnesties at the state level, because they're not coordinated with the federal government or they're not coordinated with neighboring states, you know, there's a lot of political dynamics to it. They don't end up, you know, they've not really worked so well in the past. The warlords themselves know how to play the system and game it. So, you know, I don't want to be one of those foreign experts just criticizing, say, oh, it's so obvious. You know,
nah, let me be one of them. Let me be one of them and say, I just say that in itself is a wrong approach. Because amnesty for bandits, I think if we look at the Niger Delta one, I don't think that is the way to go. I think in the Niger, in the Northwest, before I come to the last question, I think what I've seen or what I can analyze from my analysis is there seems to be a redistribution of wealth. There seems to be an attempt not to deal with the root cause. And to just, like what happened in the Niger Delta, rather than deal with the root cause, the environmental damages, it's okay, we just get Ansari, Dokubo, and all of these guys, just the warlords, just basically just give them money and then everything is done. I think that's what's going to go in, and co-optation into it too. So I think that's what's going on. And I think that until the Nigerian state deals with the root causes, there's problems that will create. But let me come to the last question because we don't have time. I wanted to use 5 minutes to talk. You did mention with ISWAP, you did mention early on when ISIS had influence, they send trainers, they send money, they send all of this. But you also mentioned that in recent times, ISWAP seems to be more influential or more to ISIS. ISIS is in a bit of a decline since, you know, I would say since 2015 when al-Baghdadi was killed. Since then, too, now ISIS center has been in decline. But now we've seen the Nigerian army chief recently made short of saying, you know, he mentioned that some, I don't know if it's ISWAP now or Boko Haram members that were being caught, were caught with some foreign currency. So just implying that there's some foreign source of funds. This has always been a narrative that's been along with Boko Haram. So what is this, just the normal trope? That the Nigerian military is just the normal trope, or is there validity in that statement?
I mean, is there validity? Sure, there is, you know, there's foreign support insofar as there are individuals and networks that are based in different, you know, outside of Nigeria that are part of this, right? I mentioned earlier that, you know, when the Islamic State, when ISIS was sending money to ISWAP in that early period, they were using this network facilitators in Dubai and Abu Dhabi. The Nigerian, was it financial sanctions or the counterterrorism task force has actually, you know, they've sanctioned a lot of those individuals. You know, their names are public, the companies are public. So you can even, you know, see a lot of that information. So yes, I mean, of course, there's international dimensions to all of this. When the military chief or when others come out and talk about foreign sponsorship and often in kind of a vague way, I think it's meant to imply, you know, some sort of organized, you know, a foreign government or organizations or stuff. Very often that's the case. And it's true that you've had this since the very beginning of the crisis, because the conflict gets caught up in political narratives, historical suspicions and mistrust and stuff. Right. So for a long time, there was a real concern or, you know, suspicion that Chad was involved in supporting Boko Haram as a result of, you know, bad relations between the Chadian president and the Nigerian president. You know, you talk to retired military people who still, you know, very strongly believe that. And, you know, they claim, you know, because that if the Chadian military was not responsive to a distress call in a border area, they'll attribute that to kind of malintent rather than, say, incompetence or something like that. So, you know, for a long time, people have accused Chad. Previously, you know, France has often been a scapegoat, I think owing in large part to just the broader mistrust of France in West Africa and, you know, French neocolonial interventions, of which there is, you know, a long track record that's quite clear and stuff. You know, obviously, I don't buy any of those narratives. I don't think there's evidence for them. I think that many of them, if you actually look at the, you know, the people that are being implicated or the countries that are being implicated in it, it's not really you know, it's not in their interests to support a group like Boko Haram. You also get, you know, sometimes allegations against international NGOs, right? Because this is another space that's quite kind of contested politically and stuff. You know, and I think, you know, some NGOs have in the past kind of, I think, made mistakes in their kind of strategic communications or whatever, and kind of, you know, explaining what their role is or not doing a good job of explaining that. But yeah, so I mean, all to say, I don't think that there's any, you know, I don't see any kind of evidence or indication that there's kind of a major new shift in terms of the financing of groups like ISWAP going on, right? What I see is that, you know, West Africa as a whole is in a pretty tense political space. I mean, I was alluding earlier or mentioning earlier the ties between Nigeria and Niger. I mean, right, the Nigerian junta leader had just previously accused Nigeria of harboring terrorists against Niger, which, again, I don't think is happening, but it shows that level of mistrust across the region. So in that kind of climate, I think you often get these statements, you know, from officials that kind of, you know, that are, again, quite vague. They're not necessarily making allegations directly, but it's kind of, and it's also a way of explaining, you know, why is this problem persistent, right? Because no one wants to say, oh, well, we've not been able to handle the situation. And I mean, there's truth to it insofar as, like, you know, Boko Haram, the insurgents do take advantage of the porous boundaries and stuff. They move back and forth, you know. A lot of the logistics that they get in Lake Chad go through Niger and stuff. So, you know, there is an international dimension to all of this, but I don't think it's kind of needs to be coded in this kind of language of nefarious conspiracy or stuff. But again, I mean, there's a reason why people believe that and why they propagate those messages, because there is a long history of intervention and, you know, conspiracy and stuff in this part of the world. I mean, I did my master's degree on ECOMOG, and you talk to retired ECOMOG soldiers who were there, and, you know, it's, you know, who sold out Samuel Doe, all that stuff. Yeah. Like, there's always intrigue, right? It's politics.
It's amazing. Unfortunately, we're running out of time, but James, like Riley said, there's definitely has to be part two of this. We could talk about, there's going to be a part two of this conversation. But yeah, this is an amazing conversation. I really, really enjoyed this conversation. I know there's still aspects that we didn't cover, but definitely there'll be a part two cover maybe when you've done more research and some of the things. But yeah, really appreciate you for the for coming again and hopefully, you know, you work your magic on our numbers. And yeah, but congrats once again for your stuff, and thank you very much for your reach and insightful comments. Thank you very much, James.
No, thanks so much, Michael, for having me. It's a pleasure.
Yeah. All the best. Take care for now.
Cheers.
Thank you once again for another very interesting episode, and have me join me in thanking our guest, our returning guest, James Barnett, for his very, very rich and insightful expose or insight into the Boko Haram's insurgency in Nigeria, its connections, and its international sources of funding. Stay blessed, and I see you again next week. All the best.